Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Emily Hanna. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. We've got a great guest, Isaac Boru, who is a radiology imaging supervisor and instructor in the University of North Carolina's Division of Radiologic Science. And he's going to talk about the work that he and his colleagues do to actually make patients more at ease, take care of patients both here and then how to really take the work they do and bring it internationally. I'm really excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
First, though, we've got some research that matters I'm looking forward to. Let's dive right in. Our very first one is about women and men calling ambulances when they get sick and maybe need to go to the hospital. How's it important?
As you know, heart disease is responsible for a great number of deaths in this country, so we definitely want to make sure that women are getting the help that they need.
And too often, we know that women get different care and maybe have delays in seeking care around heart disease. And this was actually a really interesting study of over 7,500 patients who were admitted in Poland to a hospital, and they had heart attacks, and they were trying to understand what factors maybe predicted how quickly they got to the hospital. Because if there's delays in getting to the hospital, what's one of the things they saw or thought may be happening?
So this is really interesting. They thought that male sex was an independent predictor of treatment within the recommended time frame. So males got treated more often than women within the recommended time frame.
And they really felt that one of the reasons why women were not getting treated is because they weren't calling ambulances for themselves. I'm like thinking, I wonder if the men called ambulances on their wives more frequently than they called them on themselves too. Because I do expect, you know, if I'm having chest pain, I know my wife's going to call that ambulance really quickly. Am I less likely to call it for her? Because that's also one of the questions. But maybe it sounds like that the women were potentially less likely to call it for themselves.
Right. Yeah. And I also think it's interesting that when you think of heart attack, you think pain in the chest and the left arm. But women can also have pain in the back, shoulder, stomach. So I wonder if that also contributes a little.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is that for the women who may have heart symptoms and for their spouses, men or women who are with the women who have symptoms, don't wait to call an ambulance or get to care if you're having chest discomfort or something that could be considered chest discomfort. Have it evaluated.
Exactly.
Let's talk about our next research that matters and see what we want to do, what type of evaluation we want to do here. And this is the research that many of our listeners have probably heard about. It was in the Journal of Pediatrics from the University of Liverpool about what influences social media may be having on children's food intake, and a really interesting experiment they were doing.
Yeah, they were basically just trying to find out the influence of social media on children's food intake. And what they ended up finding out is that the children in the group that viewed unhealthy snack images consumed 32% more kilocalories from unhealthy snacks specifically and 26% more kilocalories in total.
Yeah, this was actually an experiment. And they took 166 children between 9 and 11, and they kind of made up realistic popular Instagram pages. Then they showed this one group, as you said, this vlogger with unhealthy snacks. This second group was shown them with healthy snacks. And the third group was with non-food products. And just like you said, the ones that were the unhealthy snacks had witnessed it consumed more calories than those who did not, suggesting that not only do celebrity endorsements, television advertising, but social media have direct influences on kids' choice of foods.
Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah. What would you recommend that parents consider doing with this information?
Definitely to keep a close eye on what kids are doing on their social media.
Maybe watch the social media with them. I remember with my kids, I was like, oh, you know, what's that about? Can I watch it? See what they're watching, see the sorts of influences that are on there, and then have a conversation. I like to teach media literacy. You know, you see what they're eating right there. Did you know that they're trying to get you to eat that product? How does that make you feel? And a lot of times my kids go, that pisses me off, you know, or something like that. So you can train them to understand what these influences are to help limit them.
Good idea.
Doesn't hurt, does it? Speaking of not hurting, this next research that matters, I think, is something that we could all take to heart. And it's how a high-fat diet may drive cancer of the colon. I kind of intuitively think that's probably true, but this research hones down into some mechanisms that may be going on. What's going on here?
So like you said, high-fat diets are fueling colorectal cancer growth, and they found it's doing that by upsetting the balance of bile acids in the intestine and triggering a hormonal signal that lets potentially cancerous cells thrive.
Right. This was actually in the journal Cell. I like the name of that journal because it's very short. And it's clearly operating at a cellular level. These animals that have a mutation in a cell, it's called an APC mutation. It's the most common genetic mutation found in humans that have colon cancer. And that mutation seems to move faster when they're fed this high-fat diet by changes in other cells that then kind of unleash rapid growth in cancer. And of course, they're looking at this, I think, in mice and really having implications for what may happen in humans.
Yeah.
So we would say maybe really watch your high-fat foods. And if you have a family history of colon cancer, you're at risk for this. That means this gene could get turned on much easier with high-fat foods.
Yeah, exactly. And they think that's why deaths in the younger group are increasing by 1%. They've seen that from 2007 to 2016 in people under 55. They think this is what's contributing, maybe.
We'll ask our great health science librarians to put up a link to some low-fat food alternatives that taste yummy. Speaking of tasting yummy, our last research that matters is not a yummy sort of research. It's really kind of a yucky kind of research because it suggests that a chemical that's added to many consumer products like toothpaste, mouthwash, and others is actually a chemical that we shouldn't be exposed to, at least if we are worried about or are at risk for infections, which is most people.
Yeah, that's right. So like you said, so something called triclosan, it's the active ingredient responsible for antibacterial property. So it's added to toothpaste, mouthwash, cosmetics, even to clothing, baby toys, and credit cards. And they found that triclosan exposure may actually drive bacteria into a state in which they're able to tolerate normally lethal concentrations of antibiotics.
Yeah, and they did this research in mice, and so we should say that, but that it really increased when it was in mice that were exposed to antibiotics with it versus mice that weren't. The exposure to those mice that had this antibiotic, that had this chemical, actually had – and then got an an infection, had many more bacteria that survived than if they didn't have it. So this is experimental, very strong research in mice, but it suggests that there's reason to be concerned because while this may be a antibacterial chemical, it may be breeding some resistance as well in our products and foods. And I think that there is some concern about this, and others in FDA, I'm certain, are looking at this. But certainly maybe look and see and decide if you want to have that exposure yourself or you would like to not have exposure. I'm going to look at it, and I probably would choose not to if I have a choice.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, and we hope you'll stay with us as we take a short break and then continue talking with Isaac Boru, a clinical instructor at the University of North Carolina's Division of Radiologic Science, about the importance of radiology and the work that technologists do and his work taking that knowledge internationally. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Gulston and Dr. Emily Hanna. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Emily Hanna. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Isaac Beaureux, Radiology Imaging Supervisor and Clinical Instructor for the University of North Carolina's Division of Radiologic Science, about the importance of getting an inside look of a patient's health. Welcome, Isaac, to Your Health.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You know, I must say I'm looking forward to this conversation for lots of reasons, not the least of which is virtually everyone has an experience with radiology and the ability to interact with those who actually do the radiology service, not doctors usually, is a wonderful opportunity, and I'm looking forward to talking about that. But first, we'd like to know a little bit about you. What was your path to becoming involved in healthcare? It's probably not a traditional path that most people take to get into that field.
Sure. So I'm originally from Ethiopia. I'm born and raised. I came to the U.S. when I was 17. When I was very young, my dad had an accident that caused him to have internal bleeding in his head. And because there was a lack of resource in Ethiopia, that was not caught on time. And, growing up, I've seen him suffer from the side effects and what that caused him to be like, okay? So we went to the hospital a lot. We interacted with a lot of healthcare providers, some great, some not so great. And, you know, I learned the effect it has on me, my mother, my dad, of course. I've always wanted, if I go in healthcare, I want to be like those people who really took care of my dad. But not only my dad, me, myself as well, right? So they made sure I'm okay. I was young, not understanding what was going on, but they explained things for me. They made sure my mom was okay. So, you know, I came to the U.S. I got the opportunity to come to the U.S. I came to UNC. And when I picked radiologic science, I said, you know, I would do everything in my power to, you know, do the best I could for my patients as well as their family members. And UNC, that's what UNC did for me. It gave me the skill and the ability to do that.
Well, we're really grateful for that. And thank you for sharing that introduction. It's an important aspect and clearly informs who you are.
Yeah. So following up with that, what does radiology look like in the United States and how does that compare to the rest of the world or Ethiopia?
Sure. So, you know, once I became a radiologic technologist here in the U.S., my senior year at UNC, there was a big initiative to go worldwide and go to places where there's lack of resource, lack of radiology outreach. So, you know, we had few faculty members who sponsored RadAid International. It's an in-for-profit organization that goes and helps out with radiology.
RadAid. Like
yep.
Radiology Helping Aid, is that?
That is correct. A lot of times when I say RadAid, people take Rite Aid and people say, we didn't know that RadAid does radiology. I was like, no, it's RADAID. But it's RadAid International. And so, you know, I was fortunate enough to be part of the first team to travel to Malawi. And, you know,
In Africa.
Yep, that's correct. And, you know, one of the basic principle of RadAid is we don't go in to any country with a preconceived idea of what it's going to be like and what they need, right? So the initial travel would be assessment, right? So we want to assess what the situation is like and really start partnership with them. And that's what we did. We went to Malawi and we looked at the healthcare system, worked with the school as well as the hospital. And, you know, yeah, I grew up in Ethiopia. I knew what it means not to have a lot of things, but to go back as a professional, especially working in healthcare, it was kind of a little bit, you know, I was really depressed. It took me a while to kind of get used to, okay, Isaac, get it together. This is, now you're a professional. What can you do? What can you contribute, right? In Malawi, we had only one radiologist that served about 17 million people. And he was also the administrative head of the radiology. Dr. Muzumara was amazing. He did everything he could, including running the radiology department. But he could only read few CT scans because he was busy taking care of the hospital itself, the radiology department. The lack of resources, just the simple fact that, you know, there isn't enough gloves, for instance. There isn't enough bleach to clean the table after a patient with contagious disease, right? So it's very different. It's very different to answer your question in the U.S. And one of the things we did when I came back from Malawi was a little bit of debrief because everyone needed that. We needed to kind of come together and talk about it, see what did we see and how could we make change and not really just be down about it, right? So we wrote a report. It was a lengthy report, and that's what we do with RadAid as well. We do radiology readiness assessment. So that's one of our biggest tools that we use because we have to know what the resources are, what they need, what the local people capacity is, and who are our partners, the local partners, right? We can't do it by ourselves. We can't just go there and be like, this is what you need, and this is what we're going to do. Instead, let's work together. And I tell you, I learned a lot from the experience from going there, as much as they learned from me, from the little bit of lecture I took with me, right? So it's not a one-way relationship. A lot of times people think, oh, you know, you're going there to help. No, I'm going there to start a relationship and partnership. And the friendship that was created there, it's amazing. And I know that was a long answer for your question, but
it's an important answer, and I really appreciate the sincerity. I've been fortunate to do some international work in many of the countries of the former Soviet Union, who, while at one time being maybe some of the great centers of learning and healthcare, had sunken into really financially some of the poorest countries in the world. And you'd go there, and they would want to talk about the latest drugs, but yet they didn't even have aspirin in some circumstances or couldn't, you know, the poorness of the resources that they had. And so how to ultimately provide those resources, you know, because I would imagine radiology, the sorts of technology that you're using, the tools that you're using are not inexpensive. I can use primary care kind of like my – just what's in my head, you know, to kind of, you know, prevent or treat some things. But the drugs that I use for the most part aren't expensive compared to what you do. So how do you deal with that inner kind of turmoil that you allude to, but sure, yet you somehow come to a place?
Sure. So I'm glad you asked that question. And it's a very important one because sometimes – the things that we are asked from the local people may not be something realistic, right? So how do we work together to come up to a happy medium where we can work together? I'll give you an example. Recently, I went to Ethiopia in early 2018, actually. And one of the things that they were asking us was, you know, teach us how to do cardiac MRIs, right? Teach us how to do spectroscopies, teach us how to do like all these very sophisticated things. And, you know, they've learned the things, they know the physics of it. But, you know, when I went there and I said, okay, let's learn MRI, we didn't have a cardiac coil. Coil is the camera that we use in MRI. And I was like, so how do you expect me to teach a cardiac? So, and then we step back, right? So now let's talk about what we can do while I'm here, right? So what you need is the cardiac coil. Now, that brings another question. So how do we acquire the cardiac coil? So, you know, you do have a cardiac coil, but does it work, right? So it kind of opened up a completely new door saying, so how do I teach you when you purchase equipment or when you get equipment to make sure that there's a maintenance contract or to make sure that you check all the equipment that come with it, right? So even those requests that we think that are really not realistic, they will open up a door to start another relationship, another path for education and partnership. And, you know, when we came back, a lot of different people have the same experience with, you know, developing countries not having the resource to understanding of the contract and maintenance and learning business aspect of the business side of radiology, right? People don't think that there's business and buying the equipment. So that's what we do. We kind of come up with a happy medium and discuss what we can teach with what we are asked.
Well, we're glad you're teaching us, and we're going to look forward to asking you a few more questions. But we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking with Isaac Boru, radiology imaging supervisor and clinical instructor for the University of North Carolina's Division of Radiologic Science, about the importance of getting an inside look at a patient's health. You'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Emily Hanna. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Isaac Boru, radiology imaging supervisor and clinical instructor for the University of North Carolina's Division of Radiologic Science, about his work to really help us understand kind of an inside look of what's happening in the radiologic suite, as well as the work that he's doing to bring this knowledge and talent to people in health systems across the world that need that access.
Now, you recently created a scholarship to help others also travel to places in need of radiologists, which I think is really great because I wouldn't normally think that radiology can do global work just because they have limited resources. Can you tell us a little more about that scholarship?
Sure. You know, I told you about my background, how, you know, my dad is my inspiration to get in here. You know, after coming back from Malawi, one of the restrictions I had was financial. You know, I was taking student loan and traveling to Malawi wasn't going to be cheap. So, and I knew what it meant for me traveling to Malawi and coming back. So for me, I wanted to share that experience with other students. You know, I'm hooked now. I want to go back to different places. I want to go back to different people and help in different ways, right? So I wanted to share that with other students. And I know there are a lot of students who are wanting to go back to go to places, but financial restriction is a reason they can't do it. So that's kind of one of the reasons that I set up that scholarship.
You know, it's really wonderful and amazing. And it brings to mind me some work that I was able to do down in Haiti right after the earthquake that, you know, was so devastating. And I remember going down there and seeing that the radiologic equipment was destroyed and active, parts went missing, and it was just really difficult, and I wondered at times, you know, was I making a difference? And you talked about the relationship, and I think that is key and foremost, is helping people have relationships. In the work that you do, what's the one thing that you think is missing sometimes in the international field? If you had a wish list and you said, I could do one thing, would it be to bring that cardiac spectrometrist, or would it be something else?
It would be different from place to place, but I think the one thing that's really portable that people could use, I think it would be ultrasound machine. I think ultrasound machine, it's not the most expensive, but it gives very crucial information. And, you know, it can be – other specialties can be trained to utilize it, and like maternity problems in different, you know, developing countries. Ultrasound, a lot of places, if they can have it, it can save a lot of people's lives. So I think that would be, if I have a wish list, like you said, that would be one thing I would provide.
And the cost is going down, and they're hooked up to your phones.
Yep.
And it kind of democratizes ultrasound in ways that sound really nice.
Correct.
And I was wondering, so how can we or the listeners get involved in your organization in RadAid?
Sure. Actually, that's a great question because I had a lunch with an old family friend the other day. He said, you know, I saw you work with Rite Aid and, you know, I am a computer programmer. I work with the software processing, the software development of medical imaging, 3D models and things like that. And he said, I want to help. And I said, okay, I'll get you in touch with our vice president and we can use you. And he said, you know, I have experience with deep learning. AI is now the kind of the current hot topic in radiology. So he said, how can we bring AI into helping different locations that maybe it will make it really easy to help remote locations, right? So get in touch with us. Just send us an email and say, this is my expertise and I would like to help. We will find a place for you. Don't worry.
Well, and we'll make sure that we put up a link on our website for how people can link up with Rite Aid and if they want to make a donation or get involved. So that's great. You know, in our remaining couple minutes, I wonder if we could return to almost where we started, which is that beginning place of where patients come in and they see someone who, you know, whether it's for a chest x-ray and they're worried, or x-ray of their limbs, they're worried about a fracture, they're worried about a cancer, they're worried about heart failure. But universally, they're worried when they come in. What's the way that you and those in your field talk with, reassure, counsel, listen? Tell us about that type of experience.
Sure. You know, I had a patient one time who said, you know, you guys are surrounded by technology and sometimes it's really easy to kind of be detached and you don't care. It's like, no, you know, that's not it. And, you know, she asked me, so why are you in healthcare? Is it for the money? Is it because you like machine? And I said, no, ma'am, it's the care that I give you. You know, I take care of my patients the way I would have liked my dad to be taken care of at every interaction. And sometimes it's hard to, you know, focus on the patients when you have all these technologies that you need to work with. But that's one thing that we focus, especially here at UNC Radiologic Science. When we teach, we focus on healthcare. We focus on patient care, right? So how do you manage that? How do you kind of stack the layers, right? So how do you prioritize when your patient is really worried sick? Do you worry about the machine or do you make sure that the patient is okay first, reassure them they're okay? If they're cold, give them a warm blanket, right? So a lot of people don't feel good, feel home when you take care of them. Look them in the eyes and ask them, is there anything else I can do for you before they leave? It's not just technology. It's the human aspect. The human touch can do a lot for you.
Because they're very vulnerable.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And as we wrap up, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Sure. I have a lot of thoughts. So, you know, a lot of people, especially in radiology, as a radiology professionals say, I'm just a technologist. I can't do anything. And I hate that term because nobody is just something, right? And, you know, I'm not just a primary care physician. I'm not just a cardiologist. I don't know the rest of the things, right? So if you are willing to help anyone, you can find a way to help. Right. So whether it be traveling to different countries or staying here, whether it be by donating financial, whether it may be your expertise. Right. So if you are willing to contribute in one way or another, you can do it. You can find the way to do that.
Well, you certainly are contributing clinically and in leadership that reflects well on your discipline and your university. And for that, we really want to thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Isaac Boru, radiology imaging supervisor and clinical instructor for the University of North Carolina's Division of Radiologic Science, about his work and that of professionals in his field to take care of patients and to lead in bringing that care and forming relationships with people around the world. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Emily Hanna. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If any listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, it's yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My father has COPD and has been getting shorter of breath, it seems, almost every month, even though he quit smoking years ago. Recently, his doctor also said that he had sleep apnea after he had done a sleep study, and that this is making everything worse for my dad. How often does it seem that one patient gets all the bad things at once?
You know, I could certainly see how it could feel like that. I mean, COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, that's the disease that's almost always related to smoking or exposure to smoke. And unfortunately, it can occur even after someone's quit. It certainly is worse if one continues smoking, but it can occur, you know, several years afterwards. And it can be progressive, which is frustrating because you think, well, I've done something good for myself. And you have. Mm-hmm. You quit smoking, right?
Right.
So being short of breath would not be too surprising. What I think is really commendable of this situation is that the doctor also started thinking, are there anything else that could be going on that could also
right.
make it worse? Now, people who sometimes smoke could also be overweight. And if you're overweight, that's the number one risk factor for what's called obstructive sleep apnea. When you do a sleep study, you would find that out. But then when you also do what's called a pulmonary test to see how much air is in the lungs and the capacity of the lungs to get rid of that air, you may find abnormalities of both the COPD and the sleep apnea. So therefore, the person has both things. The treatments are different, though. The treatment for the COPD might be inhalers to help open up the lungs, avoiding infections, treating them if you have them. For the sleep apnea, it might be on a machine called a CPAP machine. You may have heard that, right, Laura?
No, I've seen them.
Yeah. They go.
You wear that mask.
You wear that mask, yeah. You may not look great, but you may feel much better having been on that overnight.
Priorities.
And that can actually help. You may need oxygen for both conditions, and it could be helpful. This is one of those conditions where it really is helpful to actually work with a pulmonologist, because now it's not just your primary care physician who is important in this, but I think there are enough things going on, a specialist could be really helpful. Thanks so much for that question. What's our very next house call?
Not too long ago, I was visiting my sister in Boston when I started having a fever, chills, and a headache. I felt certain it was the flu, but I didn't have any medication, so I called my doctor back home to see if he'd call in a medicine for me. He said he couldn't do it because he didn't have a license in the state I was in, and he encouraged me to go to urgent care. When I spoke to the pharmacist after spending about $300 at the urgent care clinic, the pharmacist said they actually would fill prescriptions for out-of-state reasons like this, so I'm curious why my doctor would not call it in.
You feel bad on so many levels
yeah.
here, right? You feel
yeah.
bad that, first off, you're traveling. You're going to go visit someone for a good time.
And you're
time,
sick.
And you're sick.
That's a bummer.
And you got the flu. You're going to be sick probably that entire time visiting. Plus, you're probably worried the whole time you're going to give it to your family.
Yeah, you're just contagious, too.
Right. So they're going to wall you off if they're
not
smart.
Not much of a vacation.
Not much of a vacation. And then you think, oh, you know what it is, probably because flu is epidemic in that community and you're a mm-hmm. smart consumer. And you think, maybe I should get on that medicine. And actually getting on that medicine quickly is the best chance of it being successful. So you did all the right things. And then here, your doctor says, not so quick. They're uncomfortable calling in a prescription mm-hmm. to another state. But maybe they're also uncomfortable because they maybe think you need to be seen. But they didn't say that, did they?
No, apparently, according to our listener, they didn't say that. But
right. And I think it's reasonable to say, you know, I think you need to be seen. I'm worried you may have pneumonia.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't have the flu. The medication we might call in called Tamiflu is brand mm-hmm. name, may have some side effects. I can understand all of those things. But I think simply to say, I can't call it in that state, I don't know. I mean, because I've known from experience that almost any state that my patients travel to, if they're my patients and I'm comfortable, let's say you left your medicine at home, right?
Yeah.
You need your high blood pressure medicine because you wouldn't want to go without it. And I've called in a week of high blood pressure medicine. And
yeah.
every pharmacist at every state says, yeah, I'll honor that.
Right.
But I do think this is one of those that maybe you should talk with the doctor and really find out maybe that what they were really uncomfortable about and have an honest conversation, because you do travel and, you know, at times you maybe do need something. Maybe they have a colleague that they can call on that you can call rather than going to urgent care and spending $300.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. What's our next one?
I'm a pretty healthy guy, other than some medicines I take for rheumatoid arthritis. I'm always trying to get healthier, though, and I hear everyone talking about probiotics. Should I be taking probiotics routinely to further protect my health?
Well, it seems like there's two things that everyone believes they should be taking today. One is probiotics. What do you think the other one is, Laura?
I don't know. I want to say like turmeric or something like that.
Yeah, turmeric's right up there. Yeah. I think that would be like, you know, when they had that Family Feud and it's the number three that comes up. List. Number one on the list, I think, is CBD oil.
Yeah. CBD oil's big.
Right. CBD oil followed by, you know, probiotics followed by turmeric. And in actually in all of those situations, you know, there may be places and spaces in which those are the right things to do. On the other hand, I also say there may be places and spaces where they're not necessarily the right thing or there's no evidence. And the probiotics would certainly fall into that, that there's not a lot of evidence to almost no evidence that in healthy people that a probiotic supplement keeps you healthier, right? I think a lot of doctors believe that if you're on antibiotics – that maybe taking a probiotic to prevent the antibiotic-associated diarrhea and serious infections might make sense. And there's some evidence that that could be helpful. Is it going to hurt you to take a half a cup of yogurt a day? No, probably not. It's not a lot of calories. High source of protein. Probably good for you.
Okay.
So good luck with that. What's our very last house call?
Recently, I needed surgery for my right knee. Many years ago, I had to have surgery on my left knee, and the surgeon that I went with did a great job. So I called him this time to see if he could do my other knee, only to find out that my insurance was not accepted by the provider now. He said it wasn't his choice. It was because of the insurance company, quote, kicking him off its plan. I always thought doctors were in charge of the healthcare system, but it seems that the insurance companies have more and more power these days.
Oh, that's a surprise. Surprise to me. Yeah. Never knew that.
Yeah, you know, right.
As a doctor practicing for 20 plus years, I never knew that insurance companies have more and more influence over the healthcare system. Here, you know, this is an unfortunate situation on so many levels. There's an established patient-doctor relationship, a very happy relationship for a doctor who, by all sensible reasons, did good with the patient. And now that relationship is disturbed because of insurance reasons, whether it's because the insurance company made that decision, whether it's because the doctor said, you know, the reimbursement they wanted to give me was too little, that I don't want to take it, whether it's because maybe that doctor is doing surgery in a hospital that no longer is, you know, the hospital's no longer on the insurance plan. I've seen so many changes. I usually just have to tell patients, I'll be here when it all changes back again.
Wow. I mean, it's just so, like, in addition to having a health problem, it's just you're now having to deal with all this red tape kind of stuff. I can imagine it's very frustrating.
Yeah, you almost need like a special app for getting notes to, I think, hospital and insurance administrators. You know, when something goes wrong and you just want to be empowered to do something, to be able to send, you know, you can do a TripAdvisor review of a restaurant.
Right. Yeah.
Why can't we do one of an insurance company or just, you know, get something out there that's healthy? Because I think we, you know, if we potentially had a different system, maybe a single payer system that patients overwhelmingly actually support and providers seem to support at least majorities of both, you would like to think that maybe it would be better, that you wouldn't have this constantly shifting tension dynamic. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a hard one.
It is a hard one. Well, we hope that you find a relationship with a new orthopedist. Maybe this one can recommend one of their friends who they know, and that you have a good outcome again. That'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank you for listening to Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to your health. You can send us any comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our great guest co-host, Dr. Emily Hanna, today, and our great guest today, Isaac Boru. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.